Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Good morning, everyone. Happy Sunday. I'm Julie Castro-Abrams, and we're really thrilled to see you this morning and to have an opportunity to dive in and learn a little bit more and kind of dissect a little bit about the life of some of our most important historical women philanthropists who really ended up having a tremendous impact on the infrastructure in our country in ways that I just learned about as I was able to read these amazing books. So I want to make sure that all of you, I don't know if you have a syllabus that shows you what books we're talking about today, but Catherine Pike wrote this really easy and super fun read about Jane Lathrop Stanford, who, really, really fun book to read. And then I'm really excited that we also have Alexandra Nicholas here. What'd you say? Yeah. She said, they said, keep going. So she wrote a tremendous story telling us the life of Phoebe Apperson Hearst. Very fascinating to see sort of how challenges really and the experiences that we have in our life have such a tremendous impact and then ultimately lead us to great success. And then Joan Johnson, who we found out we're both Northwestern alums and has tremendous complete overview, in fact, also of funding feminism. That's really wonderful. I'd say that's kind of like a fun first one to read. So, ladies, I'm just going to moderate, which means they're going to do all the talking. I'm just going to poke at them every once in a while. The only time we're going to have everybody answer the same question is right now. Otherwise, we're going to have different questions for everybody. But first, I'd love, maybe we'll start with you, Catherine, on the end. Why did you write this book? What compelled you? And maybe what is the most salient point you're trying to get across with the book?
Oh, thank you, Julie. Is this on?
I don't know.
Do I need to
just
forget
your
discussion?
Yeah.
Do you have
it on now?
Mine is, how do we share?
Want to use this one?
Yeah. Thank you. Okay, hello, everyone. Thank you so much for being here. Well, I guess what really inspired me to write about Jane Stanford was the beauty of the Stanford campus. I loved it so much. The quads, the gardens, the red tile roofs, and I just fell in love with it. I did my graduate work there in education, and I never wanted to graduate, but I had to graduate.
So you kept staying in academia.
And when I graduated, I went to San Francisco and I worked for the Hearst Foundations as a program officer, and that was wonderful too. I was there 28 years and I just loved it. And when I was there, I learned that Phoebe Hearst and Jane Stanford had been friends. Thanks, Steve. And they had built kindergartens together. Their husbands had been senators from California, which they called, kind of in a joking way, the Club of Millionaires, George Hearst and Leland Stanford. Seems like we're back to that trend now, of very, very wealthy senators. So I learned that they'd been friends, and also at the time, William Randolph Hearst was attacking Leland Stanford in the press, or at least his newspaper, the Examiner was, and I thought there's every reason for Jane not to like Phoebe Hearst, but when I looked at the letters, there was such affection between the women and such admiration. And I really began to see that women do philanthropy differently than men. It's not about competition, it's about cooperation. And it's about beauty and creating beautiful things to make our world better. So that's what inspired me.
Okay, does this one, is this working?
Yeah.
Is that
work?
Oh, hey, great. Well, actually, I got drawn to this topic of Phoebe Apperson Hearst for a little bit of practical reasons. I did a dissertation on Phoebe Hearst for my PhD, and I needed to hook onto a project where I could do the research that was close by, and actually a colleague of mine suggested that I look at the Hearst papers that are at Bancroft, not too far from here. And once I got started, And maybe we'll, I think we might address this a little bit later, but I was very surprised by what I found. I wasn't anticipating what I found, let's put it that way. The salient point that I'm focusing my attention on in my particular book is how Phoebe Hearst managed to rise in the world. How did she acquire the power that she got and what she did with it, basically.
So I've been writing women's history for about 20 years and previously had written about some very activist women, women's clubs who had been very active in social reform and education, and kind of embarrassed to say that I hadn't really thought about following the money until about 8 years ago when a light bulb went off and I realized that that was a really important story to tell, as well as what they were trying to do and why they were trying to do it, really the how question of how and what enabled them. And so I explored a group of wealthy women philanthropists who funded feminism, meaning the gaining the right to vote, access to higher education, and what they then called the birth control movement. And really the book focuses on two main points, and they're both very simple. One is that women need to make change for women. Male allies are wonderful, but it really took the dollars as well as the activities from these women to make change for women, and we need to do that today. And then the other very simple point is, besides the enormous impact they also had the potential to cause problems and conflicts, and so their giving was also fraught with a lot of tension with other women, with men, across class, across race, and so I examine those issues as well.
Thank you. How many of you in this room consider yourself a philanthropist? All right. Just a couple of people. How many of you have given a donation to someone in the last year? All right, then. Let's start over again. How many of you are philanthropists? Yay! All right, good. Okay, good. Well, this will be the lead in then to the next question. How many of you consider yourself feminists? All right, fantastic. So I guess I don't have to say the definition of feminism is you actually want women to be able to advance. So Alexandra, was Phoebe Hearst a feminist?
Oh, yes. definitely. She focused a lot of her giving on helping women, white, black, immigrant women, poor women, to advance themselves. And without her, she was involved both in creative and coercive giving. We can talk about that later, but I would definitely classify her as a feminist.
How many of you are coercive givers? Yes, Betsy. All right, good. All right. Catherine, how about Jane Stanford? Was she a feminist, especially considering that Stanford actually had a cap of 500 women to be admitted to the university?
Right. Jane was very supportive of women, and she claimed credit for convincing her husband to make Stanford University co-ed, which was very radical in 1891 when Stanford opened. But she did put a cap of 500 for the number of women because she wanted to build the university. She wanted it to be a memorial for her son. And she was worried when the enrollment climbed up to about 40% of women that it would become a women's college, and she did not want that to happen. So she capped the number of women at 500, and that limitation lasted until 1933 when the trustees overturned it. So yes, she was yes and no, kind of, is the answer. But she was very supportive of suffrage, and she gave Susan B. Anthony railroad passes to promote suffrage throughout the West.
Thank you very much. How many of you actually know a little bit about her family situation and why she built the university after her son? Actually a decent number. Do you want just to do a fast thumbnail, Catherine, about what happened in the
Good
family?
Good idea, Julie. Yes, the Stanfords had one son, Leland Stanford Jr. He tragically died when they were on a family vacation in Florence in 1884, and of course it devastated the parents. But they turned that around, and they used that as the reason to create a memorial in his name, and of course they created Leland Stanford Jr. University.
I thought what was interesting is that they both envisioned it, frankly, together, really, and started the university. But her husband died pretty quickly after the university. So she mostly was the steward that guided the growth and development of the university.
She saved the university. It would not exist if not.
Yeah. The book is fascinating to really understand what a huge role she played and how she really took her grief and turned it into great stuff. So, Joan, when we look at women's giving today, there are studies that show that women give to women's causes. In part because of their own experiences with discrimination. So was that the case in a lot of with the same women you studied 100 years ago?
Absolutely. And Catherine, you know the story of Jane Stanford and Susan B. Anthony and the railroad passes. Do you want to tell that first and then I'll hook on with some other women?
Oh, that is a good story, that she really had some difficulty getting the passes. Is that what you mean? Mm-hmm. Her husband had gotten any number of free passes, but she really had to fight to get the passes for her friend and for her friends, and she really received no support from her husband's former business colleagues, especially Collis Huntington, who derided the University of Stanford circus.
And so it's true that she had to ask her brother to get them
for
her?
Yes, she had to ask her brother. Yes, thank you.
So she wrote to Susan B. Anthony and said that she didn't have rights because of being a woman. If I could vote and wear trousers, I would have more rights. So despite her class, her wealth, her great privilege, she felt sex discrimination. Alva Vanderbilt Belmont is another very well-known feminist and supporter of the women's rights movement for the right to vote. And she kind of has a similar situation, a little bit different, in which she had married into the Vanderbilt family, very, very wealthy, really trying to make it, kind of push their way into Gilded Age New York society at the time. And her husband was blatantly cheating on her. So this is, you know, top echelon New York society. Everybody knew about it. And she was mortified and humiliated. And she also felt like, despite, again, her class, her race, her privilege, she couldn't really do anything to control him and what he was doing. And so she really felt like women didn't have the power that men had, and men were supposed to be protecting women, and instead of protecting women, they were abusing women. And what I think is really interesting about that is the way that pushed her to think about other women, and she tried to really relate to working class women in factories in making this claim that they were all part of a situation in which abusive men were not protecting women, but in fact hurting them, in her case, her husband by cheating on her, and in the case of women in the factory, their abusive bosses. And so she tried to forge this notion of kind of shared gender discrimination, a shared sisterhood between herself, this very high society New York, you know, 1890s Gilded Age grand woman, and these immigrant women from Eastern Europe who were much different from her and working in factories. But she really saw that they shared something in common, some sort of a bond. And I think that's something of what we see in...
There are no men that are abusing women today. I thought we solved that problem.
can I chime in here?
Yeah, please.
Phoebe, her situation was a little bit different. She... when she and George married, she thought she was going to have this lovely family, stable life in San Francisco when she arrived with George. And that dream was shattered pretty quickly when George told her when they arrived in San Francisco that they were going to live in a hotel, albeit the most fancy hotel, the Lick Hotel in San Francisco. But soon after William Randolph Hearst was born, George left. And this was very upsetting to Phoebe. She felt very lonely, didn't know what to do with herself. She didn't know anybody, basically, in San Francisco. And then early on in their marriage, George suggested that they go to Europe. And he let her believe that they would all go to Europe. But then he changed his mind. But he told her that he would provide money, whatever money she needed for the trip. However, George's partners, a couple of men she worked with, or excuse me, he worked with, refused to give her the money that George had promised her. Yes. And this upset Phoebe greatly, and she mustered up the courage to go to George and straight away tell him how unhappy she was about this. And she expected the amount of money that George had promised her, but Tevis and Hagen wouldn't give it to her. And she enlisted George's support in this effort. And George made sure that, indeed, she got the money, but not before she felt very pained and angry by the experience of having Tevis and Hagen sort of set her aside. And that sort of propelled her, along with her devotion to education, to sort of set the stage for her to go off to Europe.
So I think what these women in common and some of the other women that are in the book, they have these experiences, right? And they really see that education for women is crucial. Financial independence for women, being able to control their money is crucial, no matter who you are, whether you're, you know, a factory woman or you're one of these women themselves.
No, I simply agree with that point very much. Yes.
Okay, so we talked a little bit about crossing class boundaries and going to the factory floor, but what about race? A lot of people talk about the history of feminism and how a lot of women of color were left behind.
Not in Phoebe's case. She's probably, I would say, pretty unusual, but I don't know. I'd have to talk to both of you about that. She may have been influenced by one of her domestics in this regard, Robert Turner, who had the highest status and best pay out of any of Phoebe's domestics. He traveled with her to Europe, an African-American man born in Virginia. But she, in the early 1890s, mid-1890s, got the idea, and ideas, I think, are something that is important in terms of these women and their advancement. It wasn't just their money. They had other kinds of resources to draw on to advance them. But Phoebe got the idea of creating kindergartens in the nation's capital, in Washington, D.C., for whites and black children, and also establishing a training school for African-American women, to train them to be kindergartners. I mean, and this, Phoebe's ideas on race were very complicated, as she was, but broad-minded, yet, you know, supported the existing prejudices of the day as well. But at least she gave them some avenue in terms of opportunities for education and training to create the hope that at least they could advance themselves in some way, shape, or form, basically.
Yeah, that's such a good point, Alexandra. Maybe we should point out, too, that these women were all highly networked with each other through the women's clubs. And Phoebe and Jane, in particular, had a platform in Washington, D.C., so they met the greatest leaders of the world, really. And so they had quite advanced notions, I think. And that kindergarten training school, the Columbia Training School, was amazing that Phoebe started.
Phoebe had this knack for selecting and hooking up with and working with people who could get her what she wanted, both men and women. She had a rudimentary education. She knew how to read, write, and do arithmetic. But beyond that, she was self-taught. And she hired a woman by the name of Mary Kincaid, who was the principal of Girls High School in San Francisco, to basically be her teacher and guide when she went to Europe innumerable times. And also Jacob Bryanstein, who became her, he was a regent of the University of California. They were good friends, and he really became her Phoebe Hearst lobbyist to advance her architectural plan that she offered to the University of California, which really made her a UC Regent.
So how do we see their philanthropy impacting today, us today? I mean, beyond just the institutions that clearly have the legacy mark, but how have they influenced our philanthropic institutions?
Well, some of their philanthropy continues. The scholarships here that Phoebe established still continue at Berkeley. And their example. Go ahead.
Phoebe lives. I mean, she does. Her greatest legacy in terms of institutions, of course, is the University of California, Berkeley. Yeah. Not too long ago now, their University of California, Berkeley put on a presentation about designing the campus for the future. And so Phoebe Hearst's legacy still lives there. Her legacy lives. She was a co-founder of the PTA, which is basically a lobbying organization today for issues of concern to parents and teachers. The YWCA, she was, Phoebe Hearst was very involved in that. She created Asilomar. I don't know if any of you are familiar with Asilomar.
She was naked in the hot tub at Asilomar?
Yeah. It's gorgeous. You must go there someday if you haven't been. It's gorgeous, but it was established during the Panama Pacific International Exposition and served really as the sort of the launching ground for the activities that the YWCA was involved in and the PPIE, a myriad of activities, not just social or entertainment activities, but other activities they were involved in. And I could go on. I mean, the Golden Gate Kindergarten Association is still operating as well.
Thank you. I mean, for a lot of us, I'm a social worker by training, so, you know, it's sort of like nodding. Yeah, I know all these organizations and the legs they have today.
Yeah, one of the issues that I find really interesting was their support for education, because they supported access to higher education for women in particular, but also, as we've been hearing, you know, everything from kindergarten to teacher training, all of these levels of education. But what I focused on in my research was the support for women and access to higher education. And what I think is really interesting is that one of the pieces of that was access to coeducational institutions. So part of the story, I'll tell the Mary Garrett story, which is a great one. Mary Garrett is the daughter of John Garrett, who owned B&O Railroad. So if you played Monopoly, you know B&O Railroad. And when he died in the 1880s, she was a young woman in her 20s, single, and she inherited something like the equivalent of about $150 million in today's terms. But to go back to that earlier point, she wasn't allowed to go to college the way her brother was. She wasn't allowed to join the family business the way her brother was. So she was really passionate about access to higher education for women and the right to vote, because she really saw these as the avenues that were going to advance women. And so she dangled a gift to Johns Hopkins that she would give them the $500,000 they needed to open the medical school only if they would admit women on the same basis as men. And so they kind of hemmed and hawed. They were a little bit hesitant initially, but eventually they gave in and they took the money and they opened the doors to women. But the second point I want to make is that it's so interesting the way these women were not content to just get the doors open. They understood that to really enable success for women at these institutions, they also had to make sure that women were welcomed on campus. And that meant, in some cases, that there was a bathroom. So at MIT, the women in the 1870s and 1880s had to raise several thousand dollars to build a bathroom for women because there wasn't one on campus. Catherine Dexter McCormick, another woman that I write about, eventually gives the money to build dormitories for women because there were no residence halls for women. So if you don't have scholarships, if you don't have a women's center, if you don't have residence halls, if you don't have facilities, it really limited their access to success. And to get back to Julie's question about, this is a roundabout way of getting there, but the effect on philanthropy today. I think we have a lot of programs today which are also about access to college for especially underrepresented minority and first-generation students, but we're also focused more on what happens when they get in the doors and what kind of, you know, access to books and all of the other programs that are necessary for success as well. And that's really what they were working on through the first half of the 20th century.
You know, tell me if I'm incorrect here, but it sounds like all three of our subjects used money to get what they wanted.
And yes, they were absolutely they did.
And they were very skilled.
Very.
At that.
Very.
Using leverage, basically.
Yes.
And I would guess, I don't have great experience in philanthropic institutions or organizations today, but I would guess that's something that still goes on.
Well, listen, yes. You know, I mean, sometimes it's that bathroom that makes all the difference, right? Catherine and I actually started a giving circle together. A couple members of our giving circle are in the room today. And our whole thing is, like, get it to those people we think are the biggest levers.
Yes.
The women of color who are running things that disrupt in communities. And so we don't have $150 million, Catherine, but...
we don't, but we have the best networker in the world, and that's Julie Abrams, really.
So, Catherine, what surprised you the most when you delved into Stanford's life?
Right. I think it was her sheer tenacity. It was in the middle of the 1893 financial crisis. The U.S. government had sued the Stanford family because of some bonds that were coming due. And so the U.S. government had sued the Stanford estate for $15 million. Hmm. And for about 6 years, Jane's funds were entirely tied up in probate, and she could get nothing except she had an insurance policy that Leland had left her. And the California probate judge let her use $10,000 a month, which she literally used to pay the professors right out of her purse. And she was really down to a bare-bones budget, and she got on her private train car, the Stanford, which was the only thing she really had left, went to Washington, D.C., met with Grover Cleveland, the president who had been a buddy of Leland Stanford, even though he was a Democrat, Stanford was a Republican. She got that case on the docket of the Supreme Court, and it was decided in Stanford University's favor. And if not for her, there would absolutely not be.
Did she ruffle feathers when she was doing that? Did she upset
anyone
along the way?
She ruffled so many feathers. And
it's like it was this uppity woman.
Yeah, and in fact, as most of you probably know, she was poisoned twice. And the second one was successful, and unfortunately she died. So she ruffled many, many, many feathers, but she achieved her ends.
How did she do that? I mean, what would you say would be the important turning points or reasons why she was able to eventually get the court to
felt that she was doing God's work, really.
And very religious, right?
Yeah, and who's to say she wasn't? I mean, she was doing God's work. And so nothing was going to stop her.
So she had, let's talk about vision. So you're talking about actions, but, you know, how important was having a vision, really, to her and her success?
Yeah, it was extremely important. They envisioned the entire campus based on a mission style of architecture, although her museum is much more Grecian and classical, because they traveled quite a bit in Greece. But they had a very, very clear notion of what they wanted to do. In fact, they hired and fired many architects. The architect, Olmsted, was involved originally, and he got fired too, because they were going to do it their way. They wanted to lay it out. They were paying for it, and they wanted it to be what they wanted it to be.
Yeah, I was just going to say, what was her relationship? Can you talk a little bit about her relationship with the president of Stanford at the time? Ooh. Talk about ruffling
that
feathers.
That was contentious. Yes, yes.
Involved.
Well, David Starr Jordan talked about the Stone Ages, and that was the period when Jane was trying to construct the campus, which, as you can imagine, took every penny that she had. But he wanted the funds for faculty, and he upset her many times by saying, we'll build the campus and then the Stone Ages will be over. And but the Stone Ages weren't over. It took almost every penny she had. And it was very, very contentious.
I'd like to just talk to the issue of architecture and then difficulties Phoebe had as well. Architecture was one, actually strategy, I think, that Phoebe Hearst used to move into a position of power at University of California at Berkeley and become really made her a regent. She offered this architectural plan that had several parts to build a mining building in honor of her husband, the George Hearst Memorial Mining Building, which is still there. And if any of you have not seen it, it's been refurbished not too long ago, and it's beautiful. But also Hearst Hall, right, which, as Joan pointed out, women just on campuses just didn't have any place to go, call their own. And Hearst Hall eventually became a hall for women that Phoebe Hearst did not inform the regents when she offered the plan that she wanted the second building to be for women. She held back.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, she slipped that
somehow
in.
Sometimes that's the best strategy,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It's like, you already agreed 50%. Let's just get you over there.
Yeah,
you know,
that's right.
Get you over the hump.
But this her architectural plan, and the regents gave her the power over the entire project.
Yeah.
She supervised the project. She led the project from beginning to end. She was involved in all the politics that went on with that. The ideas that she had and her intelligence and intellectual skills came into play. But the greatest battle, I'd say, she had at UC was over the Department of Anthropology.
Yep.
It was her idea to establish the Department of Anthropology, actually, as well as the Department of Architecture at UC. But the Department of Anthropology, by this point in her life, she was a very imperious, intelligent, charming woman. And Phoebe Hearst was used to getting what she wanted. And most of the time, she did. And she wanted this department and museum to, in terms of the teaching and education, to be a department that basically popularized anthropology, that educated the masses to appreciate anthropology and artifacts and objects. And she ran into professional anthropologists in the field who were trying to create, turn anthropologists into experts and to professionalize the field. And they won.
Yeah,
which is...
So Joan, you write about the need for women to make change for women in whatever form that takes. What kind of causes did the women in your book support beyond getting the right to vote or some of the things we've already talked about? And how are they really related? Why are they interwoven?
Well, I think it's interesting the way that Alva Vanderbilt Belmont, when she was thinking about those women on the factory floor, she really thought that she, you know, with her husband cheating on her, would be better respected if she had the right to vote, and that the women on the factory floor would also get respect, right? So winning the right to vote was not just about political power, it was also about the respect that it would give women in society. It was about how it would change their marriages, it would change their position within the family, and it was related to employment, it was related to education, that all these things were wrapped up together. And at the time, they really kind of saw getting the right to vote as a vehicle that was going to lead to all of these other rights as well, which would then lead to equality. So they really saw it all wrapped up, and that these were all pieces of the same fight for women's equality. And many, I kind of go through the book and talk about the right to vote, talk about education, etc. And those same women keep popping up in chapter after chapter because they knew each other. They worked on the same causes together. They worked on suffrage together. Then they went and supported Margaret Sanger in the birth control movement. And then we see them later on supporting something else together. So they really worked on a variety of causes.
So we talked a little bit about their relationship with money. But what about this power? How does that inform the power dynamic with other men? Alexandra talked a little bit about that. But
So what I found really interesting about that is that term coercive philanthropy, which I wish I could claim, but it is not actually mine. I've borrowed it. But when you think about Mary Garrett kind of really dangling that money at Johns Hopkins, we all want to cheer, right? Hey, she used it as a voice. She used it as power for good, right? But at the same time, when women used their power in this time period, there was a lot of discomfort with it. First of all, women, you know, a lot of these women were widows or single women, and they were inheriting this money, and people didn't really feel very comfortable with the idea of women in power or women and money either. And that happened as well in their relationships with other women. So within the suffrage movement, there were a lot of middle-class women who were officers and activists in the suffrage movement, and they really resented when Catherine McCormick or Alva Belmont came in and did that same kind of coercive or restrictive giving within the suffrage movement. So Alva Belmont, for example, the headquarters for the National Organization for Women's Suffrage was in Ohio, in Warren, Ohio. And I'm sure, I don't know if anyone here is from Warren, Ohio. I'm sure it's a lovely town. But Alva Belmont, who's the queen of New York society, right, said, I'll give you $7,000, but we need to build a headquarters in New York and get rid of that little desk in your house in Warren, Ohio, which is insufficient. And she was right. I mean, she understood that in order for the suffrage movement to have a much more powerful impact, to get its message out, it needed to be in New York. But of course, the treasurer, whose desk in whose house in Warren, Ohio it was, really resented her power, and she eventually resigns from the organization. And so you see this kind of tension within the movement, and it happened to be right at the same time that J.P. Morgan was being investigated by Congress. There was a committee that was investigating him and his banking friends for monopolizing and controlling all of Wall Street, controlling the banking powers and industry. And so the headlines in the New York Times are screaming, money power, money rule. And the letters among the suffragists are shouting, Alva Belmont has money power. Mrs. McCormick has money rule. You know, we can't allow them to run the organization. So I think in terms of a lesson for today, it really speaks to the way that women's funds and other kinds of women's organizations have changed that story, have learned that lesson, and bring grantees to the table, for example, right? And are really, I think, in the forefront, in the vanguard, of kind of changing that dynamic and being able to use money to have an impact and to make social change, but to do it in a much more, shall we say, democratic way.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm trying.
I have to tell you, I mean, I think we are still wrestling with women in power. We all love to hate them. And I could go, that's not the topic of today's conversation, but we can talk after if you'd like to come have a little powwow with me. Because I feel like we love to hate women who assert any power.
I think we might have to add to that, that picture, you know, Belmont was a radical. And she really upset a number of more. Phoebe Hearst, for example, was very, very reluctant to have anything to do with militants in the suffrage movement, and Belmont was definitely considered.
But Phoebe was she really wielded her money like a male philanthropist and used a lot of the same skills and talents and to get that power.
That's part of my argument in my book.
She
used. I think we have to give these women much more credit, first of all, for their ideas. As I mentioned a few. I just don't think that money alone would have allowed them to get.
Oh my God! Their stick-to-itiveness, their courage, their
ideas, their ability and skills to make decisions about what they did with their money. Travel. Many of these women educated themselves by traveling to Europe, which was a seedbed of progressive ideas and issues. Networking, as you mentioned, Catherine, architecture. So, you know, there were so many decisions Phoebe made throughout her life that could have gone another way. I mean, she could have decided not to go to Europe the very first time her husband suggested that they go, and he thinked out on her, basically. Yeah. Yeah. It was a scary, dangerous endeavor. She was young, but she decided, well, here's an opportunity. I'm going to take advantage of it. And she went, and it transformed her life.
Did she like the fact that people called her the fairy godmother of California?
She, Phoebe was very dignified and, very dignified. She presented a certain persona, a certain public. She crafted her public image, I think, carefully. And she didn't want to taint it or tarnish it in any way. And that had something to do with many of the decisions she made about political issues. But she was referred to as the fairy godmother in a number of occasions. Publicly, she went along with it and said nothing about it. But privately, she mocked the label.
Yeah, yeah. It made her so much softer, so we could actually accept some of her. Yeah.
Well, it also implies
she threatening to be a fairy godmother.
Implies she had power, but it was only temporary, right?
Exactly.
It'll fade away.
Yeah. Okay, so Catherine, we talked just a tiny bit about religion, but can you tell us a little bit more about how religion really formed Stanford, Hearst, all different, female philanthropist philosophy?
Yes, I find that really interesting because Phoebe Hearst, Jane Stanford, and another really well-known philanthropist, Ellen Browning Scripps, they all supported a wide variety of religions. Because they felt that religion was overall a force for good, but none of them identified strongly with any particular religion. You might disagree a little bit with me about Phoebe and Presbyterianism, but to really identify with it, I think that wasn't the case with these women. They felt it could be a force for good. But Jane, actually, I think she was a mystic. I think she had a mystical conversion.
She seemed a little off, actually.
Some people thought she was. I mean, it was not beyond her to just say, "Did you hear that, God?" I mean, she didn't like what people said, and she said, "God wouldn't approve of you." So God was really...
So she was the channeler.
She was speaking right through him.
Uh-huh. Phoebe Hearst was raised a Cumberland Presbyterian, which was considered to be a reform radical wing of the Presbyterian Church. Both of her parents were Cumberland Presbyterians. But she, I agree with you wholeheartedly, as far as Phoebe Hearst is concerned, she was never a devout Cumberland Presbyterian. She believed in the general religious principles of the church, but she did not regularly attend church. She raised William Randolph Hearst with no church affiliation. In fact, she was much more concerned with shaping William Randolph Hearst into a powerful politician. her decisions where to send him to school were consciously made to help him develop networks and connections with the right people that would make him into a power in politics. And so she did not talk to God, though.
So, Joan, so a number of the other women philanthropists also sort of seem to have very strong core convictions. Were they from a religious faith, and how did science play into this? You know, we talked about starting, the birth of the birth control.
So Catherine Dexter McCormick, I would say her faith was in science. She once said that biochemists would inherit the earth, and she really believed in kind of a feminist technology that by supporting the doctor and scientist who developed the birth control pill in the 1950s, she was directly giving them about $150,000 annually and buying all their equipment for their lab and everything that they needed directly. She bypassed Planned Parenthood because Planned Parenthood wasn't supportive enough and was giving them the money directly. And she really thought that science could transform women's lives, that science held the answers, that it could be used to create a new effective form of birth control, in particular for women, and that women really needed that reproductive control in order to change their lives. And when she gave the dorm the money for the dormitories at MIT, and when she right before she died in the early 1960s, she had the pill had just gotten FDA approval, and she writes a letter to someone in which she sort of says that, you know, it was really the time to get these dormitories built and to really get women to MIT and get them into scientific careers, because now they could control their reproduction. So she saw that as essential, and she saw science as kind of the vehicle that could make all of that possible.
So let's talk just a little bit about the genesis of people's money and sort of that relationship with it and where we are today. So we're talking about what I think is, maybe correct me here, Joan, you're the true, you know, the one who's probably got the biggest span of information. You know, these are women who inherited or, you know, had money because through their husbands, let's say. But then it seems like for the most part, when they wielded the most power is when the men were no longer in the picture, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So do you feel like there were other women who had just as much influence, but their husbands were given credit? Or do you think there's something about being having the freedom or the responsibility of being on your own to find how you're going to truly make your mark in the world?
Yeah, I think yes, both. Yes to both of those ways of thinking about it. Most of the women in the book were either widows or single women. And then there were some women who were unhappily married and divorced. And there were a couple of happily married women whose husbands also supported them as well. And there were some women in relationships with other women also. So it's kind of a mix, but for the most part, they're widows or single women. And I think that they had the ability to spend the money as they saw fit. One of the things we see with Catherine McCormick is that she's able to give to the suffrage movement while her husband was still alive. Unfortunately, he succumbed to mental illness, and he was put into a family home here in California in Santa Barbara and kind of out of the picture. But she stayed married to him so she could eventually inherit his vast estate. And then once he died, that was when she wrote to Margaret Sanger and said, okay, what do we need now to get an effective method of birth control? So I think there's definitely some truth to that ability of not having a husband or a male in the picture that enabled them to spend that money as they liked. Although a lot of the other women who supported birth control were married, and I wonder if in some to some extent, they were women who, first of all, appreciated the need for access to birth control, and then second of all, could kind of get away with it a little bit more easily.
So supporting, they already had maybe kids of their own.
Yeah, they were
whatever,
supporting
right?
such a controversial cause, mm-hmm. but were married, so it was more respectable.
Phoebe Hearst sort of bridged the two. She, you know, George loved what he was doing. Mining and his business and political interests. And early on in their marriage, George handed over to Phoebe Hearst control of a large amount of his fortune. Don't know exactly how much, I couldn't find that figure, but and essentially gave her the money to deal with the philanthropic issues. He didn't have any interest in that, nor did he have any interest in social affairs or social entertainment. So while she was married to George, she had control of this large amount of money, and she at first really didn't know what to do with it. I mean, she had no training or experience, nobody she could talk to about it, and she was alone, basically, trying to raise her son without George around much of the time. So I may have alluded to this earlier, but it was her trips to Europe using that money that gave her the opportunity to gain the knowledge and create ideas to basically shape an independent and separate identity from her husband, which turned out to be a philanthropist.
Yeah. Well, it sure seems like things haven't completely changed. I mean, if you look at the Gates, if you look at Chan Zuckerberg, you know, Catherine, are we moving to a place where women now are making their own money and in becoming major philanthropists?
Oh, yes, I absolutely think that we are. And in fact, I think we're entering a golden age of women's philanthropy, and it's just really starting. There's a group called Women Moving Millions, and actually, Julie, you're the expert on this, but I believe there are about 217 branches, and a woman has to give $1 million to
over
be part
years,
of it. Over,
I think, is the, right.
Yeah, and they've given already almost $1 billion. Yeah. No, we're entering a golden age. Absolutely, we are.
Yeah, I keep doing that. I go, yeah, but, Betsy here is my financial planner, leader, friend. I don't think we're there. I don't think, one, we're not making enough money, we're not prioritizing it, and therefore we're not wielding it in ways that I think are going to truly shift the world. And so I still think we're playing small. And in fact, I know a number of women who've made their own money. Like, they are the ones, and they're, in fact, their partners or husbands have stayed home with their kids for many years, but they still kind of go to them for permission, almost. I do think that this relationship with money is so fraught and
complicated. Why do you think that's happening?
Well, I think that there's this issue of it being indelicate, or that women have to walk this very, very fine line. I have a daughter working at a tech company, and after a year there, they had some scandals, and they did a whole adjustment to everyone's salary. And my baby, my 24-year-old, got a $22,000 raise because she was making less than the men that were hired at the same time.
Wow.
So, you know, the lifetime implications of that are tremendous. And then also on your psyche about how you relate to money. If you aren't, you're not making enough to truly wield it. Anyway.
I mean, for Phoebe Hearst, this was a tricky business.
Yeah.
I mean, she constantly had to maintain a balance, pleasing her husband, as well as the other men she was dealing with politically, as well as trying to use her wealth in ways that were acceptable. Yeah. She was very ambitious, and she had to rein that in. Yeah. So this is a big challenge. It's not an easy business at all.
I think the Women's Philanthropy Institute down in Indiana at the University of Indiana has done some studies, and they do show that women, single women, are more likely to give give a larger percentage than men. But men are earning more, so their total givings are more, and that families in which women are part of the decision making are more likely to give as well. But I think part of it is also related to what they're giving to. And so in some cases, you know, are they going to give to an organization that funds women and girls because that's really what they feel passionate about? Or, might they just give to something 4%
less? Only 4% of all U.S. philanthropy goes to organizations for women and girls organizations in the U.S.
Really?
8% total, but the rest of it goes internationally. So, the numbers are... It doesn't mean women and girls don't benefit from the rest of the 90% plus, right? But it's not designated for them. So women, I'm on the board of this network of women's foundations called the Women's Funding Network. And the women's foundations, I think, are still playing very small. Doing creative, cool, disruptive things, but we're not wielding the Gates Foundation money.
But Julie, wouldn't you say that there's a lot more to it than money? I mean, the way women do philanthropy, it's quite a bit about networking and advocacy and looking at everything you've done in your life and everything you've been passionate about and committing to it. So it's not just money.
Like you said about these women, right? Giving in a network, a community of people who help them. And there are a lot of Women Moving Millions is one, but there's also the Women Donors Network. There's a lot of cool networks for women. So how many of you in this room are in a network of a circle of giving of some sort, women's circle? Oh, no. Wow. Please put that on your put that on your to-do list. It really elevates your thinking, and you don't have to give very much. Mm-hmm. It really doesn't have to be a lot.
I've been working on this book a long time, and some of these organizations that you're talking about, I've never heard of before.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering what are they doing?
What? Oh, well, How Women Give. You can join the How
Marketing
Women Give Network.
And advertise. I mean, putting yourself out there.
I think sometimes we still, myself included, maybe think that that's a tiny bit indelicate. Isn't that silly? Why are we like that, Catherine? I don't know.
No, that's a good point. Yeah. And many people have donor-advised funds and will in the future. And really, that's a good way to give. And the money should not just sit at Charles Schwab or Vanguard. It needs to get out and actually help nonprofit organizations.
Well, and there's some cool, innovative things that are happening. Like, if you have your money invested like in a donor advised fund, you can actually use it multiple times. There are a couple micro loan funds, and there's also a startup. I'm on the board, so I'm just going to do a little disclosure. A fintech startup called Lend Donate, where you can take your assets, you can lend it to a nonprofit that has a capital project or another thing that they're working on, and then you get the funds back, so that you can then donate out into the world. So figuring out, like, how can I use my money more than once, you know? go ahead. Yeah.
I'm just curious, what do you see as a solution to this issue of delicacy and getting
maybe if my husband dies. No, I'm just, sounds like that's part of the story. I still like him, though, so I'm not
kicking him to the curb. I'm suggesting
what do you think, Joan?
There were a lot of widows in my book. Well, one of the things I think that kind of speaks to this a little bit is that when the suffrage movement was kind of moving very slowly, and so when Alexandra said, you know, well, Alva Belmont was kind of radical, there was a more militant wing that wanted to picket the White House and really be much more visible. But even Carrie Chapman Catt, who was part of the more moderate group, understood the need to be out there in public eventually. And so she actually inherited $1 million gift. So this is in 1914. In 1913, the entire budget for the National Women's Suffrage Association was $38,000. So everything they were going to do for the entire year was $38,000.
I think it's back to that.
The following year, she inherits $1.7 million. By the time the lawyers and the relatives and everybody else gets to it, she ended up with basically just under $1 million. So she goes from $38,000 to $1 million. And the two things she did with it, I think, are really relevant to thinking about women's philanthropy today. The first thing was publicity. So she hired 25 full-time publicists, women, to send out everything from cartoons to editorials to statistics to, I mean, you name it, silent movies. They had a stunts bureau so you could have a car in your parade. I mean, everything. And they spent a lot of money on a journal, which Susan B. Anthony said it was really important to have your own newspaper or magazine in order to sauce back your opponents. That's Susan B. Anthony's words. And at the time, you know, think about it, the New York Times was against women's suffrage, right? If you wanted to create a positive message, you had to put it out there yourself. So she spent a lot of money on that. She called it an education campaign. And then the second thing she did was learn how to get more political power. So she paid for a headquarters in Washington, D.C., and hired full-time lobbyists who had to learn how to lobby Congress, teach each other what they learned, and more effectively then lobby for an amendment. So I think those two things are really important.
We're supposed to learn from this.
Just as a little aside about that, learning about lobbying, they were telling each other things like, you know, don't go see a senator right before lunch because he'll be distracted. But, okay, nothing's really changed. They also said, do not go into a senator's office alone and allow the door to be closed.
You know, Phoebe Hearst, as you may know, was very press savvy, obviously because of her son. And she made sure, she gave a... She put on a YWCA conference just before the Panama Pacific International Exposition to really become the representative at the PPIE for the YWCA's national goals and their political issues. And she invited the press. She made gave them very comfortable arrangements, made sure that they were reporting on the events at the conference and that those stories would get out. I would
hope. So if we fly them in and put them up at the Four Seasons, they're going to do a story on us? Is that what it is? Sounds about right.
She created the entire conference at the Hacienda del Pozo de Verona. She set up 300 tent housing. I mean, it was a big thing. But
I wonder if they know how impactful they were. Do you feel like they really felt like they were successful while they were alive? I mean, for so many people, the ripple effect is the real impact.
Well, Jane had a very distressful end, as we know. I mean, she was poisoned, and she knew she was poisoned. So she was horrified that anyone was so disturbed or distressed with her that would happen. So, yes and no. I mean, she was certainly proud of what she'd done at the university and that she preserved it, but her end was very disappointing, of course.
You know, it was generally unacceptable for women to boast about their accomplishments or talk about their success in public. Privately, Phoebe Hearst wanted from time to time to be acknowledged for her work, but she didn't have a large ego at all. So, you know, really it was up to the press and her connections that put the word out there. But the press was particularly key because they reported on what she did so much of the time.
You want to chime in?
Okay.
So we have just a couple more minutes, and we could actually take a question or two from the audience. Does anyone have a question, or should I go? Yes. I'll repeat what you say, since there's no microphone.
Are your books available for sale?
Can they buy your books?
Yes. They're supposed to be.
I have to tell you, they're really fun, interesting reads. They just not feel like a slog at all. They're really interesting.
One of them is an observation. Yes.
Frances Perkins. Social Security.
They knew a different kind of women's philanthropy involved there, where Mary Harriman, who was part of the wife of the railroad baron, he really funded her life,
which made it possible for her to be in the cabinet. Otherwise, she couldn't have done it.
Yeah, well, and women back then certainly couldn't have made money, that kind of money, right? So with
Eleanor Roosevelt, of course, and her network were key to putting her in that position.
Yep.
And one more quick question for Catherine is, a lot of people said that David Starr Jordan might have been the murderer of Jane Stanford. Just curious if you had it.
Well, Dr. Robert Cutler really, I think, wrote the definitive book about Jane's sad end and proved that she was poisoned. And he said there were two likely subjects who might have done it, suspects. And one would have been David Starr Jordan, although he didn't think that was very likely. And the other might have been her personal assistant, Bertha Berner.
Wow.
But whoever did it got away with murder, for sure.
Wow.
Ooh.
So exciting.
Everybody wants to ask a question. I'm going to watch the time so we can get out of here on time, but yes.
Just make sure to use the mic.
So you didn't really answer the question about women's circles and how can we find out about them and join them.
Well, so I'm on the board of the Network of Women's Foundations, so you can write me. We have a giving circle called How Women Give, and I'm connected into almost every women's foundation around the world, somehow at least one degree of separation away. So julie@howwomenlead.com. julie@howwomenlead.com. Happy to...
Phoebe Hearst was the patron of Julia Morgan.
Yes.
Did she also sponsor other women professionals?
Oh,
yes. Phoebe Phoebe Hearst did offer Julia Morgan money while she was attending University of California at Berkeley to help her get through the program there. Julia turned her down. But once Julia Morgan came back from her schooling in Paris, Phoebe Hearst was instrumental in helping her start her commissions in architecture and really propelled Morgan's career with her connections. And Phoebe, yes, helped. Without Phoebe Hearst, the female students at the University of California, Berkeley, would have had a very tough time surviving, literally. Because they were placed, once they were admitted, they faced a very hostile environment on campus. It was an all-male campus. 1870 was the first year UC Berkeley admitted women, eight women. The entire campus was men except for eight women. So, yeah, she helped many professionals, not only women who were being trained to become professionals at UC Berkeley, but others in the medical field, for example, in San Francisco. Phoebe Hearst was instrumental, and she became the head of the board of directors of the Pacific Homeopathic Dispensary in San Francisco, and really forced male physicians who were on the staff at the Hahnemann Medical College to bring to work with female physicians. And the way that she did that was by suggesting that she, getting them to recognize that she might withdraw her money and other people might withdraw their money.
Getting them to recognize, yeah. Otherwise known as threatening.
Being diplomatic.
Yeah. Do you have a question?
So looking at literature in the late 19th century and early 20th century, and looking at the broader social movement, like what do you see that really helped these women emerge? Because for me, sometimes it seems like it was up here in terms of women's consciousness and feminism, and then we kind of had this dip, and we're kind of trying to get back in some ways to whatever helped these women emerge and take the power that they took.
You mean these individual? I mean Phoebe Hearst, for example, or. You know, it's really not a simple story. I'm sure there's some luck involved, but basically, it's Phoebe's intelligence and her ideas and skills and her ability to form systematic plans and make systematic decisions. She really knew where to put her money, when. She was also able to develop male support, mm-hmm. which was key, particularly at the University of California, Berkeley.
But Alexandra, don't you think that the women's club movement also played a lot to do with that?
Yes, absolutely. She was the first president of the Century Club mm-hmm. of San Francisco. Mm-hmm.
Well, and many of them, it was kind of new money, right? It was the explosion in the gold rush, et cetera, that fueled much of their wealth, right? And the railroad, building the railroads, et cetera. And it feels to me like when you have new money, you behave differently than when you have sort of like a legacy and you're trying to sustain it.
So I think that those two things are happening at the same time. So women are beginning to really become organized, right? They have the first women's rights conference in the world in 1848. But they're organizing through churches, they're organizing through the Women's Christian Temperance Union, they're organizing for suffrage, they're organizing through women's clubs, fraternal orders, all of these things. And that's all related to increasing their access to education as well. That's a really important role. And at the same time, you know, we're coming into the Gilded Age, we have all this new money available, and we have changing philanthropy, right? We have Carnegie and Rockefeller who are beginning to give large amounts to try to solve the root of problems. So we're moving away from kind of a charity to a more scientific philanthropy. And these women are just right at that confluence. They're just perfectly poised to take advantage of both of those new trajectories.
Well, and like in California, it was sort of a blank slate, right? It's sort of like, how are we going to build up California and what institutions? And it's a moment of opportunity.
And you can chime in here, Catherine, but for Phoebe Hearst, the fact that she was in the West
was very important. Oh, yeah, is this not working?
Hello?
Ooh, oh, look at that.
All right. Thank you. and I would guess Jane Stanford. They were in the West, and yes, there was a tolerance and a freedom out here that allowed them to grow and develop and establish themselves as these, I would argue, powerful women. It was sort of a blank slate. There weren't that many established, long-lasting institutions out here in the West, for example.
And the women inspired each other. I mean, when the Stanfords put $20 million into a campus, then Phoebe said, wow, I mean, now we can do this for Cal. And Ellen Browning Scripps said, yes, and we can do it for Claremont.
Yeah, and Phoebe has that quote where she's talking about her support for women's suffrage, and she says, in part, in California, women have had the opportunity to be in business, right, to be entrepreneurs and to be in business, and that experience is so essential to their ability then to take the next step and have political power as well.
I think we can take another question. Yeah.
Curious, obviously we could all just sit and listen to you all for another few hours, but I'm interested in the disagreement between Julie and Catherine about how you see women's giving now, and I'm wondering if you see generational differences. One brief comment, I went to a women's college, and my generation became academics. This generation of alumni are in hedge funds, law firms, business, mentorships, internships, and it seems as if their approach to giving and to money is shrewder, more entrepreneurial. Being an entrepreneur is okay, even in one of the seven sisters, you know, etc. So I'm just curious, Julie, if you either.
Well,
of
I don't
you
know if we really have a disagreement. I just thought it was fun to just, like, you know, banter a little bit. But I mean, you know, you can. I'm not satisfied. And yes, there is an uptick in all of those things you just said that Catherine referenced. Right, a golden age of networks as well as women coming into their own substantial wealth. But the evidence I have so far is that it's new. It is not something that I feel like has fully tipped. Is not a tipping point quite yet. That's my personal belief. Catherine, you challenge me, baby.
No, well, we know. I'm a rose-colored glass kind of person. But Maggie, your question was really perceptive and really great. I think that you have to have examples of women doing incredible things, which we have now. We're starting to have, and I think it's coming. There are more women and entrepreneurs.
There are a couple other interesting books I just want to point out, but you should buy these first because then you'll know the whole history. My friend Betsy over here has a book called Power Up in Her Hands. Magdalena Yasil, who a Turkish immigrant, came to this country and ended up becoming a very significant venture capitalist, first board member at Salesforce. She's terrific, super fun, interesting book. I'd encourage you to check it out. And the other one is The Soul of Money, which is an old book. A lot of us have read it many times. S-O-U-L of Money by Lynn Twist. It's just a really interesting frame on thinking about money, and a lot of us have issues with, you know, money. We're taught all kinds of things about it's the root of evil and all kinds of silliness. But she's got a good frame on how to think about it. Can we fast take one more question? Somebody else had a question.
The stories you told are of these philanthropists that are saying, I want this to happen, or the Johns Hopkins example. But do you have any examples of and if this even existed at the time, a fundraiser coming to these women and saying, would you be interested in this? Instead of them saying, I want this to happen, I want this to be built.
Yeah, that is such a good question. Sarah Brown Cooper comes to my mind. Were you thinking of her too?
Yes, and many others.
Yeah, and she was friends with Jane and Phoebe. Oh my gosh, there were so many people trying to, I don't want to say exploit, but there were so many women trying to get to these women, to get to their money, just like now. Yeah, absolutely. A great fundraiser.
And then they also were soliciting each other as well. So Mary Garrett, when she created a fund for the Women's Medical College, she called Women's Medical School Fund, and she gave $350,000 of her own money, and she raised the rest. She had circles of women in different cities, and they were all supposed to solicit 20 women and gather up the money that way. So I think people are approaching them from different organizations. They're getting begging letters, which you guys could talk about as well, and then they're also part of this network, and they're soliciting each other.
We're out of time. Go fast.
Oh, yeah. Well, just, you know, most of the materials in the Phoebe Hearst collection at Bancroft are people writing to her asking for money. Yeah. So she spent a lot of her time trying to figure out who she could trust and figure out what decisions she was going to use to make.
But I would say one of the morals of the story for a fundraiser here is women love being a community and learning from each other. And a network of women is a powerful way to really get everybody to step up and feel more confident. Please join me in thanking these brilliant women who worked so hard to give us these great stories. Ladies, I wish I could say we'd learned from this history and we were done, but I think we need to all review it again and figure out what we need to bring back. Thanks, everyone. Enjoy the rest of your day at the Book Festival.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.